It is Monday, May 18th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Coming up on the program, the claim of capture in the Iraqi city of Ramadi by the Islamic State militants. And did President Obama tell Arab states what they wanted to hear?
He did the best he could. He said, we're going to give you more equipment. We guarantee we'll come and support you. We'll do what we can. But they can't take away that question of, if you have a relationship with Iran, it diminishes your relationship with us.
Also ahead, the King of Blues dies. The Islamic State group on Sunday claimed to have seized the Iraqi provincial capital of Ramadi, giving the militants their largest victory this year after days of intense clashes. In Washington, the Pentagon refused to confirm the militant statement, saying only that Ramadi remains, in their words, fluid and contested. But others, including a spokesman for the governor of Anbar province, said government soldiers were fleeing the city. My colleague Victor Beatty asked career Army officer, now senior political scientist at the RAND Corporation, Rick Brennan, for his take on all of this.
I think that the information the Pentagon's putting out is accurate in the sense that it's a contested city. The battle is still going to take place. There are still pockets of resistance of Iraqi police as well as Iraqi military within the city. And the prime minister is trying to spirit together sufficient Iraqi forces, both on the Iraqi army, national police, and more recently getting the approval of the Ambaris to bring the Shia militias into that fight. And they've coordinated with the United States over that. And the position of the United States has been that as long as the Shia militias are working under the command of the government of Iraq, that they'll keep providing support. So it's contested. It was significant in the fact that they captured the Anbar Operations Center. They were able to raise the flag, but they no sooner got there than they had to disperse and to go out into other areas out of fear of U.S. airstrikes. So again, it was a victory for tactical victory for ISIS, but the battle's still taking place.
This is located just 125 kilometers west of Baghdad. How significant is that?
Very significant. What you're seeing is with the capture, or when to the extent able to capture Ramadi, what you'll end up with is having the cities of Fallujah, as well as the Ramadi and closer to the Syria border, hit and all under the control of ISIS. And so that gives a natural avenue of approach where ISIS can approach to go not from Ramadi through Fallujah into some of the areas in and around Baghdad in the future. So it is a significant advance should they be able to hold this. But again, the battle is still taking place, and we have to watch this.
That's Rick Brennan, senior political scientist at the think tank RAND Corporation. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. And now we turn to my colleague Jim Stevenson, who looks at the fight against the Islamic State.
In a rare move Friday and into Saturday, U.S. Special Forces staged a ground raid in eastern Syria, killing an Islamic State commander and capturing his wife. The White House and Pentagon on Saturday confirmed the death of Abu Sayyaf, who reportedly directed IS oil operations. Cal Perry is our host of VOA's popular hashtag VOA program. He spoke with former Deputy CIA Director Michael Morrell about his new book, The Great War of Our Time, The CIA's Fight Against Terrorism. Cal is in our studio with us. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, Jim.
Tell me a little bit about what the former Deputy CIA Director had to say.
Well, on Syria, he really, you know, he academically said there are five wars being fought in Syria, but the one that he focused on was the proxy war between the Saudi Arabia and Iran. And he said the U.S. should back Saudi fully in this war, which I thought was surprising because it's a bit of a departure from the administration's position, certainly as they carry out nuclear negotiations with Iran.
And also, it's an interesting situation with Islamic State on the ground, al-Qaeda operating in Syria, and a bit of a quandary for the United States.
Yeah, and certainly for this president, and when you speak to the former, you know, deputy director of the CIA, he makes it very clear that, that when you're talking about going into Syria, you're talking about going into a place that is lawless, and a place where the U.S. has not had intelligence on the ground. And this is an administration that is still living with an agency that is grappling with the catastrophe that was weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. So these hard and fast decisions, you know, are a lot more difficult to make in that shadow.
Cal Perry is host of the program #VOA. Still ahead, analysis of last week's GCC summit in Washington.
#VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at #VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, @PerryCal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
Last week, President Obama hosted a summit of six leaders and senior ministers from the Gulf Cooperation Council. That happened at Camp David, the presidential retreat outside of Washington. After the talks, President Obama spoke to reporters.
We discussed not only the Iranian nuclear deal and the potential for us to ensure that Iran is not obtaining a nuclear weapon and triggering a nuclear arms race in the region, but we also discussed our concerns about Iran's destabilizing activities in the region and pledged cooperation around how we can address those in a cooperative fashion.
Mr. Obama said the United States has an ironclad commitment to the security of its Gulf allies and would consider using military force if they were threatened. The Gulf Arab states came to the Obama summit with concerns the potential nuclear deal with Iran could eventually increase the threat of Iran in that region. Well, for some perspective on what happened at the summit, VOA's Carol Castiel speaks with Graham Bannerman, former Middle East analyst at the U.S. State Department Policy Planning Bureau, and Alex Vatanka, senior scholar at the Middle East Institute. The first question goes to Bannerman, who was asked if President Obama was able to convince the GCC leaders that they can always count on the U.S. when it comes to those security guarantees.
This is one of those strange diplomatic events where you could not succeed, you could not fail, but it was necessary to have. You couldn't succeed because the gap between the United States and our Gulf allies on the question of Iran and some of the other regional issues is so great, you could not bridge them at this time. You could not fail because the strategic interests of the United States and the Gulf states are so important to each other that they had to succeed. It was necessary to have it to have a good discussion of these issues, identify the differences, but try to bridge them as much as you could, and I think they did that.
Turning to you, Alex Vatanka, for your perspective regarding the success, failure, or somewhere in between, as Graham Bannerman suggested, of this summit.
Clearly, the Gulf Arabs feel that the United States continues to be on the path of ignoring them. I mean, one could make the argument that's been the Gulf Arab position going back to early 2003 and the invasion of Iraq, which in the eyes of the Gulf Arabs was a strategic mistake because it empowered the Iranians. And now they feel that the Iranians are still winning as a result of either U.S. action or inaction. And when we talk about inaction, they feel that what the U.S. is not doing in Syria is right now the most strategically damaging policy that the U.S. could have from their perspective. So I think, you know, as Graham said, there are a lot of things that they're demanding from the United States. But frankly, I think the Gulf Arab states are failing to take a step back and look at their own policies for a second and always seemingly looking to the United States for a quick solution. And in their eyes, a quick solution is the United States be much more hawkish on Iran, continuing the sanctions and preventing Iran from coming back to the international mainstream, which by and large, I think there is no consensus for in Washington. The consensus in Washington is if the Iranians are willing to make adjustments to the nuclear program, change their behavior both at the home and in the region, then they should have an opportunity to prove their credentials. And I think that's where the gap is.
Turning to you, Graham Bannerman, What Alex just said reminds me of an interesting analogy that I heard lately. Let me bring that to you. We know that there's a tradition of several wives in the Arab world. One can take on several wives. So somebody said recently to me that the Gulf Arabs, perhaps they feel like the first wife on whom the husband is showering many gifts because he's taking on a second wife, and that second wife is Iran. Do you see that analogy to some extent?
No, I don't really. I think they're more worried that they're following the American pattern of the second wife being following the first wife. They're more worried about being excluded. They see the relationship in the Gulf as a zero-sum game. So therefore, any positive movement of the United States towards Iran, even if it's signing a treaty with all sorts of restrictions, somehow diminishes their relationship with the United States. That was the gap the president could not cross. He did the best he could. He said, we're going to give you more equipment. We guarantee we'll come and support you. We'll do what we can. But they can't take away that question of, if you have a relationship with Iran, it diminishes your relationship with us.
So, Alex Vatanga, do you see that as well? The perception on the part of the Gulf Arabs that this is really a zero-sum game. They can't quite bring themselves to see a potential change in the relationship because as much as the United States says the deal, should it come to pass, does not mean that the United States and Iran will have a rapprochement, so to speak. But nonetheless, it seems as if the Gulf Arabs think that this will follow on. And this, as Graham Bannerman said, appears to threaten them.
I mean, if you travel in the Gulf region, what you hear from many officials among the Gulf Arabs, basically, at least in my mind, falls under borderline conspiracy theories, that there is some sort of a hidden agenda plan here being concocted in Washington where the United States and Iran will look to cooperate in many different arenas against the interest of what the so-called Sunni Arab nation. I don't believe that for a second. But I do at the same time have sympathies for some of the concerns of the Gulf Arab nations. Look, at the heart of this, there is nothing Washington can do about some of the real structural problems that the Gulf Arabs have because of the small size of these countries, by and large, when compared to the Iranians. So if you want to go back 40 years ago, some of the issues that are dividing the Saudis, for example, and the Emiratis existed when the Shah of Iran was there. It's a reflection of the smaller countries fearing a bigger neighbor. Now, obviously, those fears were escalated following the 79 revolution, but the fact is, there is nothing the United States can do about the size of Iran. On the point of what U.S. can do, certainly in the context of the nuclear negotiations, what we've heard in recent weeks from the Saudi side in particular and the Emiratis also is that, look, it seems like you're going to sign this nuclear deal, but for God's sake, try and get some points, try and get some concessions as part of these talks from the Iranians, which is, look, why don't you push the Iranians a bit more in Syria and what they're doing elsewhere in Yemen and so forth? And the White House, you know, stuck to its initial policy, which is to say we're not going to bring any other issues into the framework of the talks. We're going to stick to the nuclear agenda. And that's what they've done. So I think on that issue, certainly the U.S. administration under the stewardship of President Obama could have been a bit more open to some of the real fears that the Gulf Arab states have about what Iran is doing in the region.
That was Alex Vatanga. He and fellow Middle East analyst Graham Bannerman appeared on the VOA program Encounter with host Carol Castiel. You can hear more of their conversation by going to our website at voanews.com and look under the Programs tab for Encounter. Now here's VOA's Michael Lippin with what they're saying on social media about President Obama's GCC summit.
Thanks, Steve. Now, I had a look earlier at comments posted by our audience on two recent VOA web stories about the Obama Gulf Leaders Summit. Our national security correspondent Jeff Selden filed a report on May 14th about how the Saudi officials at the summit faced two competing priorities, whether to fight the Sunni extremist Islamic State or the Shiite militants backed by Iran. Now, a web reader with the name Passerby had this to say: Saudi Arabia would be digging its own grave if it began directly supporting the Islamic State. That would not sit well with the U.S. and might even push the U.S. more toward Iran. And in the end, the Islamic State has designs on the House of Saud as well. Now, the House of Saud is a reference to the Saudi monarchy. Now, we also had more than 20 comments on an article by White House correspondents Aru Pandey and Luis Ramirez looking at what came out of the summit, including a pledge by Mr. Obama that the U.S. has what he called an ironclad commitment to the security of the Gulf nations. Well, Bruce, a reader from Canada, wrote, "Ironclad commitment? Iron tends to rust, and Obama's assurances seem to fit into that category. How about stainless steel next time? Well, we welcome your comments on all of our stories on voanews.com. Just scroll to the bottom of each page to find the comments section. Steve, back to you.
And many thanks to you, Michael. You can follow Michael on Twitter if you'd like. His handle is @Michael_Lippin. I'm also on Twitter as well. I'm @VOA Norman. And still ahead, a bit later in the program, the latest on the crisis in Burundi.
Here are the news headlines from VOA. The Saudi-led coalition resumed airstrikes against Shiite rebels in Yemen after the end of a 5-day humanitarian ceasefire Sunday. Airstrikes hit rebel positions in the southern port city of Aden. The Islamic State group is claiming to have seized the Iraqi provincial capital of Ramadi, giving the militants their largest victory this year. In Washington, the Pentagon refused to confirm the IS statement, saying only that Ramadi remains fluid and contested. Israeli demonstrators and police clashed with rock-throwing Palestinians Sunday in occupied East Jerusalem as thousands of Jewish nationalists marched through the city, marking the 48th anniversary of its capture during the Six-Day War. Several police were reported injured and at least 6 Palestinians arrested. I'm Ray Kugel, VOA News.
This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Also in the news, Burundian President Pierre Nkurunziza is in his first public appearance since attempted coup last week. Sunday warned of a threat posed by Islamist al-Shabaab militants in Somalia. Mr. Nkurunziza said, "We are preoccupied by the attack by al-Shabaab that was declared." The Burundian leader also referenced Burundi's conditions and contribution of troops to the African Union force fighting the militants in Somalia. At his Bujumbura news conference, the president did not mention the failed coup plot or the protest over his bid for a third term in office. He was in Tanzania for a regional summit on Burundi's political situation when a general announced the coup attempt last Wednesday. It was crushed by loyalist forces. Violence over Mr. Nkurunziza's decision to seek a third term has left at least 14 people dead, wounded more than 200 others. More protests expected later today. It is the worst violence to hit that Central African country since a 12-year civil war ended in 2005. It has also caused a refugee crisis, forcing more than 100,000 Burundians to seek refuge in neighboring countries. This refugee, among 50,000 stranded in an overcrowded lakeside village on the border with Tanzania, says they don't feel secure at home. After youth militia threatened them, he says things got worse, and the violence in and around the capital as well got worse. The president and his supporters argue that a third term is permitted because he was elected by parliament, not voters, for his first 5-year term in 2005. Also in the news, the United States has expressed concern over the death sentence handed down to ousted Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi among more than 100 co-defendants on Sunday. A U.S. State Department official said Washington is deeply concerned by yet another mass death sentence, as they put it, handed down by an Egyptian court to more than 100 defendants, including the former president. Spokesman added, "We have consistently spoken out against the practice of mass trials and sentences in Egypt." Mr. Morsi, who was elected in 2012 but ousted by the army in 2013, and his Muslim Brotherhood co-defendants were convicted Saturday on charges of killing and kidnapping policemen, attacking police facilities, and a mass jailbreak, in 2011, happened during the uprising against the former president, Hosni Mubarak. Meantime, Egypt Sunday hanged 6 men convicted of killing soldiers last year. The men who were hanged Sunday in a Cairo jail were reported to be members of a Sinai-based militant group with ties to the Islamic State. Nigerian military on Sunday said it destroyed at least 10 Boko Haram camps in the Sambisi forest on the country's northeast. Defense spokesperson said a number of insurgents were killed in the operation. One soldier was killed in a landmine explosion. Nigerian forces work jointly with troops from Chad, Niger, and Cameroon, having slowly gained the upper hand against Boko Haram since February. The group's 6-year insurgency has left more than 15,000 dead as it tries to create an Islamic caliphate across northern Nigeria.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock, on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
Take your pick. Watch on television, log on to the internet, or listen right here on the radio. Hello, I am Shaka Sali, the host of Straight Talk Africa from The Voice of America. Each Wednesday night, I'll put you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they, you and I, talk about the most important social and political issues in Africa. Shaka Sali saying, I'll be waiting for your call Wednesday night on Straight Talk Africa from The Voice of America.
Blues fans are mourning the passing of Riley B. King, better known to the world as B.B. King, the singer, songwriter, and guitarist who became known as the King of Blues. He died recently at his home in Las Vegas at the age of 89 and had not been able to perform since he broke off a tour last October because of illness. VOA's Greg Fleckus has more from Houston.
B.B. King will be missed by millions of fans, but his loss is most painful for those who worked with him and knew him on a personal level. Houston-based trumpet player and singer James Boogaloo Bolden has been with the B.B. King Band since January 1980, serving as band leader and music director.
Well, you know, B.B. is very nice. He's very considerate of everybody. And working for him, you know, working with him was a real pleasure. He always made sure that you and your family were well taken care of, always.
Bolden says B.B. King's transformation from a blues singer to an international superstar began with his crossover hit, The Thrill Is Gone, which won a Grammy Award in 1970. But Bolden says King's exposure to a young, international audience began when he toured with the Irish rock group U2.
We did a six-month tour with them in 1989 with U2. And after that, the audience really, really changed. It was a big, big crossover. The audience started getting younger and younger.
Riley B. King was born in Mississippi, where he was exposed to the Delta blues of the 1920s and 1930s. But he also listened to big band music and jazz on the radio, according to Blues Foundation CEO and President Jay Seelman, speaking from his office in Memphis.
He was more influenced by some of the more urbane and advanced guitar players, including jazz guys like Charlie Christian and Django Reinhardt.
Seelman says King got his first big break and his moniker while working for a Memphis radio station.
He was a DJ on WDIA. And I had his 15-minute show, and he had to sell a product, and he got a chance to tell people where he was playing, and that's where he picked up the name Beale Street Blues Boy, eventually shortened to BB. It all started right here in Memphis.
The next phase of King's career had a Houston connection. He toured what was then known as the Chitlin Circuit in southern states at a time when segregation confined black players to small clubs that drew black audiences. Roger Wood, author of books on the blues like Down in Houston, says this helped him build his African-American fan base.
His rise to prominence occurred during the years that he was booked by the Houston-based organization called Buffalo Booking Agency, which was an adjunct of Don Robey's music empire. Don Robey was the founder of the Peacock Records label, the Duke label, and other labels.
By the time segregation ended in the mid-1960s, blues music had been given new life by folk music enthusiasts and by rock bands, in particular British groups like the Rolling Stones, who had B.B. King open for them on a concert tour in 1969. There are now many musicians playing the blues, but Roger Wood says there's no one who can replace B.B. King.
It's not like the last blues man has died, but the most prominent blues man of our lifetime, an icon in that pop cultural sense, and that will not be replaced by anyone.
Wood says B.B. King's legacy will live on through musicians who continue to study and emulate his style, and fans who will continue to listen to his lifetime of recordings. Greg Flakes, VOA News, Houston.
I think for everyone here in the studio, we can say we will miss B.B. King. Also in the news, the first week of the Cannes Film Festival came to an end this weekend. Plenty of buzz there. Natalie Portman, the actress, also a director, talked about her new film. Directorial debut, the title of the film, A Tale of Love and Darkness. It's set around the time of the formation of Israel, but the Oscar-winning actress says it doesn't have a political agenda. The film adapted from an autobiographical novel by Amos Oz. It premiered over the weekend at Cannes. It charts the birth of the state and the boy's initiation into realities of disappointment, they say, and death. And how about this one? Actor Jude Law is the new pope. Can you believe it? The British actor will be playing the fictional Pope Pius XIII in the film entitled The Young Pope. It is a miniseries directed by Italian filmmaker Paolo Sorrentino. Series, a co-production of HBO, Sky, and France's Canal Plus, was announced on Sunday in Cannes, where Sorrentino's film Youth is competing for the Palme d'Or. Filming is due to begin on The Young Pope this summer. And Jane Fonda, starring in films, many of them at Cannes, have shown in the past. Well, she was there over the weekend this time to pick up an honor by the festival for all of her contributions to Women in Motion program. It recognizes the work of women on the big screen. And before we say goodbye, we're going to get a little business news with our Phil Alexio.
This is BizBeat.
If you have a car, lower oil prices means cheaper gas. In the U.S., you now save $10 on a 13-gallon tank from a year ago. But for countries relying heavily on oil exports, the drop means lost revenue. During the 2008 global financial crisis, Africa was spared major damage, mostly because of its underdeveloped financial markets. But today, the continent's a victim of plunging oil prices. Nigeria and Angola are the largest oil-producing countries, and oil companies there will now have to consider if they want to move ahead with billion-dollar projects that need higher oil prices to make a profit. And while most consumers enjoy the lower prices at the pump, social safety nets in less diversified economies are at risk. Less money for HIV prevention, for example, less buying power for imported goods, and loss of revenue for governments fighting extremist groups like Boko Haram. What's an economy to do? Economists say become more diversified. For VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexio.
Many thanks, everyone, for joining us today on The Voice of America for International Edition. Brand Director Tracy Carter and Engineer Jim Harmon, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope you have a great Monday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States continues to find new ways to support global entrepreneurship. At a time when the world is more interconnected than ever, said President Barack Obama, we've got unprecedented opportunities to help more people access capital and resources and networks that they need to succeed. Youth around the world are particularly in need of greater opportunities. More than half the world's population is under the age of 30, and in some countries, youth unemployment can exceed 35%. When so many young people don't see a future for themselves, it holds an entire nation back. That's why the United States seeks to train and empower thousands of aspiring entrepreneurs. As part of its Young African Leaders Initiative, the U.S. offers training and grants and online resources and courses and leadership centers to help young entrepreneurs build businesses in Africa. In Southeast Asia, the U.S. has connected young people across the ASEAN countries through the Young Southeast Asian Leaders Initiative. The U.S. has also launched an initiative for young entrepreneurs in the Caribbean and Latin America. All told, the U.S. has set a goal of generating $1 billion in new investment for emerging entrepreneurs worldwide by 2017. Half of this money will go to support young entrepreneurs and women entrepreneurs. The program, known as the Spark Global Entrepreneurship Initiative, will bring together some of the most successful entrepreneurship programs across the government and make sure that they're working with the private sector in ways that allow for long-term sustained success. Some of America's most successful business leaders and innovators are joining this effort. One of those is Julie Hanna, who will use her expertise leading Kiva to increase access to capital around the world. Her project commits to delivering $100 million in crowdfunded loans to 200,000 women and young entrepreneurs across 8